Hey, Three Song Story listeners, we love keeping this show free and easy to download for you. But to do that, we do have to remove the full versions of the songs from this version of the show. But if you want to hear the full versions of the songs in the interview, the way we did them in the studio, go right over to threesongstories.org or use WGCU's app and you can listen to the show exactly how we did it. Plus, you get to hear the song at the end of the show that each host chooses to tell you a little bit about themselves. All right, here's the show.
One, two, three.
Welcome to Three Song Stories, the podcast that digs into a person's life, history, and personality through the songs they choose and the stories those songs connect to. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. My guest this episode is Mike Donlin. Mike is Creative Services Manager here at WGCU, where we make this show. That pretty much means he's the station's graphic designer, although I'm pretty sure he's got way more on his plate than just design. Formerly a newsroom graphics editor for Gannett Newspapers in Florida and California, Mike also teaches visual storytelling in Florida Gulf Coast University's journalism program. He's a native of Southern California, is married to Lee County Visitor and Convention Bureau Communications Director Francesca Donlin, and has a son in college and a daughter in her senior year of high school. I've got to know Mike a bit around the station and like his laid-back vibe, which resonates with mine, and I hear he does quite the robot German accent for the D&D game he's in with our co-creator Richard. Here come Mike's song stories. Hey there, Mike. Nice to get to know you longer than a brief moment in the hallway.
Yeah, it's nice to be here. Just right up front, the German robot is not coming out today.
The German robot's not coming out today?
No, I don't think I can muster that.
Okay, we got to stop right there because something's not right with you, Mike. I can't. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, and I can hear myself a lot better too.
What do you mean the robot voice isn't coming out? Come on. We can't urge you for a little bit of it?
I'm going to have to think about that, but basically there's alcohol required for such things.
Oh, so you're not playing sober D&D or Gamma World. You're playing to have a few beers Gamma World?
Exactly. Okay. Possibly a little mezcal.
Are you going to be joining our upcoming campaign that Richard's been putting
absolutely,
together?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm absolutely in.
What kind of character are you going to use?
Well,
it's not going to be a robot arm that can move.
No, not this time. Whose sole mission, by the way, was to save the Von Trapp children. No, I'm not sure. We're still waiting on a more thorough description of the world in which we're going to be playing to sort of size up characters.
Okay,
and
you didn't figure we were going to be starting here, did you?
No, I did not.
My daughter's going to play too, by the way. She's very excited. But now we'll move on to three song stories. What was the musical background of your childhood?
Well, I think it was. It was actually pretty interesting. My dad grew up playing the piano, and so we always had a piano or two in the house. And so there was always piano music going on.
So live music was
live music, yeah. And, you know, and we always gave my dad a lot of hell for it. And he was the type of guy, it still is the type of guy that generally gets a lot of ribbing for just about anything he does. And so, the piano music was just – it was really fantastic, and he would play all sorts of stuff.
And he was good?
Yeah, he was good. Really good. And he still is. He plays in a jazz band now in Los Angeles and does more improvisational type stuff. But back then he did you know, pretty old school stuff like ragtime and a lot of classical stuff too. So,
did you play anything, or did anybody else
God,
in the house play
no.
anything?
No, my sisters tried. You know, took lessons for a couple of years, but the bug never stuck with me. But my mom was always musical too. I mean, in a classic kind of hippie sense, like, you know, every once in a while the auto harp would come out.
Oh, and,
right?
Yeah.
And
definitely some hippie flavor in that.
I know.
Auto harp.
And then this one time I'd gotten back from a trip to Hawaii, and that I'd gone on after I graduated from high school. And just as a goofy souvenir, I picked up, you know, like a $10 ukulele mm-hmm. For my mom and brought it home and presented it tour, and she just tuned it right up and started playing songs on it. Like, so she'd always had this kind of, love of music and, you know, facility with whatever she picked up. I just turned 50 last year, and they bought me a banjo. And now I've got to figure out how to play this banjo.
You haven't gotten to it yet?
No, it's really intimidating. It's a whole new thing. So.
The guy who did our theme song, Dave, he was my roommate years ago. He kind of taught me how to play the guitar, but the advice he gave me that I followed, and it works, is you just got to pick it up every day for at least 15 minutes. And in a year, you'll be able to play it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just that familiarity. You got to have it in your hands, even if you're just doing the one thing you know how to do over and over for 15 minutes.
Right.
Within a year, you will be playing that instrument.
Yeah.
It takes that persistence.
And that's real. Like, I play the guitar very poorly. Like, and that's all I really want out of the banjo is to be able to play it poorly.
Yeah.
But I'm not even there yet. So we'll see. Time will tell.
So, but besides the piano, what was the popular music, or what was, you know, if you had a radio on, or if you were in the car, what were the kinds of music that were being played around you?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was always a lot going on. I mean, me and my two sisters, we all each had our own turntables, and so we all had our own little stashes of records, even as little kids. And it was sort of like Wes Anderson, like that way, where we'd all just kind of lay around and listen to records. And then, of course, really, it got serious with the 8-tracks.
Wow. Our first, like, actual 8-track user.
Oh.
That's admitted to it anyway.
Yeah,
I had 8-tracks around me when I was a kid, but, you know, I was very,
oh my
very
God.
Young.
No, so. I was hooked on the 8-tracks. My first 8-track that I bought. I inherited a lot of music from my oldest sister, Kathy. But my first 8-track that I bought was the Cars Candio.
Oh, nice.
And
I just love imagining the Cars on an 8-track. That makes me happy.
It was fantastic. And, you know, the great thing about an 8-track was, and my family would not agree with this, is that you could leave them in and leave them running for literally months at a time.
Right.
And I did. And so...
endless loop.
Right. It was an endless loop of Candio. And I still know every song on that album back and forth. Lots of 8-tracks. And then, you know, of course, there was my sister's music, and she was much more into the sort of rock and roll stuff. So there was always a lot of, you know, Zeppelin and Rush and... Yes, and Jethro Tull and that sort of stuff.
This was where in California?
This was Riverside in Corona, California. There's this new...
And where about is that in California for the non-Californians
right,
in us?
It's in one of the worst parts of California. It's basically about an hour inland from Los Angeles.
Oh.
And we're... you know, right up against the mountains there. So we would catch all of the L.A. smog. L.A. always had nice clear skies because we would get their air pollution.
Right. You inherited all their problems.
Exactly.
Air quality-wise.
Yeah. And the other thing, living so close to L.A. is, you know, my parents were always big music buffs. And we would go in as kids to Los Angeles all the time to go check out the symphony. And so we had season tickets with the LA Phil, and so we were, you know, three or four times a year we were going in to see concerts as a family.
So exposed to some classical, something bigger than just Led Zeppelin on the radio,
right? Exactly.
The Cars on your 8-track.
Constant exposure to this sort of stuff. So,
How long did you live in California? At what point did you get out of there? Did you go to college there? Like, what's your sort of what's the short version of the arc from there to Florida?
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see. I grew up in Southern California. College at Chico State, California. That's in Northern California, about 100 miles north of Sacramento. After that, back to Southern California for a little bit, and then off to Japan for a year. Then after Japan, Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I met my wife. And then back out to California, this time on the Central Coast near San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay, and then to grad school in Boston for a couple of years and living in Rhode Island, then back out to California to live in the desert in Palm Springs, where I started newspapering seriously, and then from there, here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Japan. How'd that happen?
Yeah, it was basically just an ad in the LA Times, live and work in Japan. And
what were you doing?
I took them up on it.
Teaching English?
Teaching English, yeah, in their public school system over there. So I was 24, getting paid a lot of money and had no responsibility. And it was just an amazing time.
That would have been like the 80s?
Yeah, no.
I'm trying
90,
to do the math. You
right?
say you're 50, so that's
92.
92. Okay,
92
I got my decade off.
There, so, yeah.
What's the first musical memory that you can remember if you have to try to dig back to something that stuck?
Well, it's more a visual thing, but like it actually goes back to what I think, you know, and memory is such a weird thing. But my very first memory that I can put together is being carried out of in my parents' arms of a amphitheater where there was, as I'm told, we were leaving a Joan Baez concert.
Mm. So you remember just like the departure.
Right. Yeah. And in the just sort of outdoor, peacefully kind of nature of the thing. But yeah, in if I had to go back further or not as far, but to something that I
– something a little more concrete.
Yeah. I would say one of the very first concerts I went to with my parents was a unstaged opera of Bela Bartok's Bluebeard, I think, done by the L.A. Phil sometime back in the 70s. And it was very freaky. It was kind of terrifying as a kid. Just the creepy nature of the music. It's a kind of a horrific story. And our seats at the Dorothy Chandler were always like the top balcony. And it's one of those really steep theaters where you get kind of vertigo looking down into the audience and everything. And so as a little kid, it was it was really kind of otherworldly.
Hmm. Besides the Cars, did you have a band that you like glommed onto first? You know, like for me, it was like the Police. Like I sort of fell into the Police, and suddenly that's all I wanted to listen to while I was, you know, in high school.
Yeah, and I'm almost ashamed to admit it. Adam and the Ants.
Oh.
You know?
I don't.
I was a child of the 80s for sure.
You know, I guess I really don't know much of his music. I could picture the, you know, the shirtless with the thing around his neck or whatever.
It was all a little silly, you know. It was that whole new British invasion or second British invasion or whatever they called it. And there was all sorts of fun music going on. But I think it like they would always talk about with Adam and the Ants that Burundi beat with the drums, you know, and so I don't know, it was kind of catchy.
Do you ever see him perform live?
I did, yeah. I saw him, and that was I think the first concert I went to was an Adam and the Ants concert,
and that was out in California somewhere.
That was out in Riverside, and INXS was opening for
them. Oh, so you got to see INXS open for wow.
Yeah. It was and they were
they're
amazing.
One of my early around that same time. Yeah. I still play kick all the time.
Yeah.
Like it's in my rotation.
It was fantastic. I have almost felt sorry for Animat because INXS just pretty much blew him off the stage.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on to your first song. What is your first song? I have it written down here, but I'm going to let you pronounce it.
Well, I'm probably going to pronounce it wrong, but it's Der Erlkönig.
How would the robots? I'm kidding.
I cannot do it.
Okay.
But it's a Schubert later. And again, I don't speak German. I don't profess to, but it's either Lieder or Later. I don't know what it is, but it's a German art song. It's something that I just kind of fell in love with as a kid. And the first time I heard it was in high school. And I went to high school, and there was for just 1 year, there was a period of time where me and both of my sisters were attending the same school. And I'm not sure it was that particular year, but somehow I wound up in the same Latin class with my sister Ellen. And our Latin teacher was a guy named Mr. Webb, Basil Webb. And he was just a complete nut. I mean, you know, and I don't know if that's a universal quality for Latin teachers, but he was really, how to put it, he had a lightness of being that he brought into the classroom that was really infectious. And I think a lot of sort of misfits felt pretty safe in Mr. Webb's class.
Hmm.
And so he also taught German. And he was the type of teacher where he would leave, you know, and he smoked like a chimney. And so he would sneak out and do cigarette breaks and make up some excuse for not being in the classroom. And while he was gone, we would all do things like rearrange the room or like hang his bicycle from the ceiling or
and he was willing to put up with it because he was getting his cigarette out of it.
Exactly, exactly. And he would act perplexed when he got back. And it was that kind of an atmosphere where but at the same time, everyone really kind of took it seriously. He kind of shared his love of language. And that's, you know, I was not a good student, particularly. You know, I grew up in a very academic household. My dad was a professor. My mom was a vice principal of high school, and teaching is kind of the family business. And I just, you know, was bored out of my mind most of the time at school. But Latin class with Mr. Webb was the first time I think that I saw a teacher who really loved what they were doing. And it was the first time that I felt like education might be okay. Hmm. Like it might be kind of fun, at least in that period of high school and junior high school. And as a matter of fact, this song, you know, is in German. We were in Latin class, you know, and so he had, you know, this was back in the day when you had to request the turntable to be, you know, sent to your
classroom. Yeah, you had the media center or
exactly.
Whatever, they'd bring it down for you.
And so he had it in there to play this song for his German class. And because it's sort of a classic, as I'm told, for people learning German. And he just loved the song so much and loved the lesson associated with it so much, he just thought we in the Latin class might enjoy it too. And so he, you know, pulled out the turntable and put the record on and acted out the song for us while it was playing.
Wow.
So, and it's this amazing song. It's I forget what they call it, but it's an ancient poem. I think like coming from, you know, somewhere in Scandinavia or somewhere. And it tells the story of a father and son who are, you know, riding through the woods, and the son is deathly ill and is hallucinating, perhaps, you know, and seeing this dark character skirting them in the woods.
And he's acting this out.
And he's – right. And so one of the fascinating things about the song is that it's one singer, but the singer actually plays four parts in it. And so it's a real challenge for any, you know, singer to be able to articulate the four different roles clearly. And and he was obviously lip syncing, but acting out each of the parts, and did a fantastic job. And it was just that enthusiasm, you know, that has stayed with me, 35 years now, you know, that, and every time, you know, and I do, this is one song that I actually do hear on a regular basis, you know, I've got it in rotation all the time, and there's something about it that, you know, I've always just loved. And every time I hear it, I think about, you know, Mr. Webb, you know, he's the type of teacher that you'd make a movie about, you know, in the mornings, you'd see him riding to school on his bike, you know, on some old 10-speed, no hands, you know, hands out at his side like he was flying, singing loud songs in, I'm guessing, German at the time, and just that sort of thing, you know. But, yeah, Mr. Webb.
All right, well, let's hear this in honor of Mr. Webb. It's
The Elf King is the translation.
It's The Elf King by Franz Schubert. Any idea if he's still around?
Mr. Webb? No, he's not. I'm sorry. No. I looked him up a couple of years ago, and he's passed. And I think he went ahead of his time. He wasn't an old guy, but and I miss him.
Did you keep up with him at all after high school, or was that kind of the end of y'all's contact?
I think I went back and saw him once after high school, and because I had some, friends who are a year younger than me, and so visiting them, I popped in once to see him.
It's amazing how people can make an impact like that lasts so long, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I had one of the teachers that was that impactful to me was my junior year English teacher, and we're connected on Facebook now, but she hasn't been communicative. You know, we've been friends for years, mm-hmm. and we haven't really. And just out of the blue the other day, I got an email from her saying, "Keep up the good work, Mike. You're one of the good ones." And it's like, oh my God, she's paying attention and she thinks. And it was like such affirmation. It's man.
Yeah.
And I have another real quick story that reminded me of. In sixth grade, our math teacher was this guy named Mr. Northcutt. And he was a strange character. And he, at the end of the year, he came in with his cello dressed in army fatigues and played CCR for us.
Oh, wow.
Fort Myers Middle School, 1985.
That is fantastic.
Okay, let's move on. Right. When was the last time you bought music that had a physical form? Or maybe we should back up a step and say, how do you listen to your music most commonly these days?
Oh, I'm trying to catch up, and now I'm doing, and I'm kind of name blind, so I'm going to forget something, and I might need help. It's an app. With a little green button on it, and I get all the music I want out of it, and I can't remember the
name
of it. It is Spotify.
Okay.
Thank you.
I've never actually loaded the app, so I was guessing. Yeah. But
no, it's and it's really fantastic. The I have a ton of music on CD and a ton of music in my iTunes account and everything. But the thing that it's not a plug, but the thing I really like about Spotify is. The ability to go deep, so there are bands that you listen to maybe as a kid because you had your sister's record, And you really liked it, and you can't necessarily afford to go out and buy all of these, you know, tracks or albums going back and back and back. But, you know, Spotify allows you to kind of explore an artist the way you want to, you know. So I've been going through lately and listening to, you know, from the first album to the last, bands like, and again, Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix. And and mostly these are the bands, and I'm not necessarily that fascinated with these bands, but my son is. And so...
kind of a shared thing. You can dig back in. He gets to hear it all for the first time.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we've got more to talk about that way. And it's been really fun. Yeah.
It's interesting. That's come up several times during episodes where people talk about how, you know, it used to be you had to have the money, you bought it, and then maybe you sort of felt almost committed to listen to it because you've invested in it now.
Right.
And so it really kind of created tunnels of listening. And now with the ability to listen to so many things for so little, if not free, it's just opening up musical horizons for everybody that's choosing to look. I mean, if you choose to look, boy, it's just all there.
Like the album I've been stuck on lately, I've just been looping it back and forth like it was an A-track, is Liz Phair's first album. And I can't remember the name of it, something Stranded in Guysville or something like that. But it's just a fantastic record.
So back to this first half of that question, when was the last time you bought music, like a CD or a record or an 8-track or anything like that?
That's a really good question. Gosh, I honestly can't remember.
Quite a while then.
Yeah, I would get for myself. I honestly can't remember. Again, for my son, we get him, you know, vinyl every once in a while for his turntable, and we've gotten him a few CDs here and there, and he's finally moving away from that as well. But it's sort of. For like a thing person like me, it's kind of hard to move away from the piles and piles of CDs, you know.
You still have them?
Yeah, and now they're all just stacked up. No more jewel boxes. They're just stacked up on a spindle, and I'm sure most of them are unlistenable by now.
You know, Tom DeMarkey, who is a writing professor here at FGCU, he's got a special room on his house where he keeps his more than 10,000 CDs that he still listens to this day.
That's fantastic.
10,000.
That's insane.
Mixtapes. Was that ever part of your thing?
Yeah,
were
sure.
You were the right age for that. So reflect on the mixtaping that you did. Did you make them for people? Did people make them for you? What do you recall?
You know, I think to have exchanged mixtapes would have implied that I think there were more friendships back then. So I was making them really for myself. I know we briefly touched on Japan, and we're going to go back there in a second. But I had made myself half a dozen mixtapes to take to Japan that kind of kept me alive over there, you know, through all the culture shock and isolation over there. So those were constant companions. My, you know, bright yellow Walkman.
Waterproof one?
Yeah. I still have that.
So. You know, I got one of those. Somebody left it in a lost and found at a place where I was associated with, and nobody claimed it after however many days, and I got it.
Fantastic.
And I was like, oh my, it was my favorite thing ever.
Yeah.
For you listeners out there that don't know what we're talking about, it was a tape player Walkman, but the yellow one you could close up and it would seal. So if you got it wet, it wouldn't ruin it theoretically.
Right. Yep.
Do you listen to music while you're working, like if you're doing a big design project? Because that seems like the kind of thing that's on the borderline between you can listen to music while you're doing it and not. Where do you feel full?
Yeah, no, I do more and more now. And most of my office suite mates don't seem to mind that much.
So not earbuds, speakers?
Yeah. And I was at when I was at the news press, I was in there for, you know, close to 15 years. And that was a staple in the art department was loud, obnoxious music, just almost 100% of the time. And earbuds were, not cool. You know, everyone had to kind of share the experience, and we did, and everyone kind of got along, and I'm sure some of the people who were in there weren't pleased with the choices all of the time, but yeah, I felt that was important. And we've kind of restructured around here a little bit, and now I think it's we're getting back to the point where things are a little more open and fun. You know.
Do you miss the newspaper vibe, the newsroom, the, you know, big team crashing on daily deadlines?
Exactly.
And all that stuff?
You know, I really do. I miss the work. I mean, I love what I'm doing now, and I love the people I'm doing it with. But, you know, there was something about doing graphics for a newspaper that was like, it was, you know, it was like going on a field trip every day. Mm-hmm. You know, and going out and because we would do these huge detailed visual explanations of how things worked and, you know, or a statistical look at, you know, the county or the state or something for who knows what reason. And so it was a constant exposure to weird aspects of the community that we all lived in. And then this the other side of that was this sort of puzzle solving. Everything was a puzzle to figure out how you were going to execute a graphic or what your take was going to be with a particular set of numbers and, you know, what the story was embedded in, you know, half a dozen spreadsheets. So that I do miss. And I'm lucky enough that I get to teach some of that stuff in the journalism program here at FGCU.
Time for song number two.
Excellent.
You kind of teased it a little bit ago. You kind of said we're going to get to that. So what do we got?
Okay. This is kind of a weird one for me. I mentioned before that I spent a year in Japan, and it was – and I bring it up, and I think anytime anyone in my family or who's known me for a while, whenever I bring it up, I get kind of the eye roll because it does come up from time to time is this experience in Japan. But it was really transformative. I mean, living for a year in a different country for, you know, kind of a small town kid.
And that's
like
a pretty foreign country in terms of the culture shock.
It's about as foreign as you can get, I think. And especially with the language. And it didn't occur to me before, but, you know, the first song had this sort of like language sort of schism in there between the Latin and the German and not knowing what we were.
Are we there seeing a theme develop?
Right.
Is what you're
but I don't know. This just seemed to kind of happen. But then the maybe the whole thing is just miscommunication. And when I got over there, there was just this tremendous culture shock. And I lived on this tiny little island about 100 miles outside of Tokyo. It was about a 12-hour boat ride to get there, and they hadn't finished the airport yet, so that was the only way on or off.
So you weren't living like in the big metropolis. You were living
in a
rural part of Japan.
No, it was really old school. It was a fishing village.
Oh, okay.
And very, very traditional. And, you know, the house I lived in was – you know, this classic Japanese house with, you know, the paper screen windows and the tatami mat floors. And the whole front of the house would open up and overlook the ocean and situated so that the sunset was right outside, you know, this huge panoramic view. And it would set over this bay with little rocky islands and windswept palms and everything.
Sounds pretty idyllic.
It was incredibly idyllic. And, I mean, it was really challenging in other ways. I mean, the culture shock and the isolation. I was the only guy that, you know, wasn't Japanese on the island and the only guy that spoke fluent English. And I didn't speak Japanese. That was sort of a weird thing about the program I was in, was you didn't have to speak Japanese.
Did they want you to, or did they
not want you to? Not necessarily, because the whole thing was supposed to be team taught with a Japanese teacher of English. And that, in my instance, kind of proved to be a myth. And so it seemed – I kind of figured out over the first couple of weeks that – the real mission there was to be more of a cultural ambassador. and to encourage this island nation, you know, the youth of this island nation, that, you know, their horizons were broader than they might have suspected. And essentially, it was fun. So there's this whole myth. Oh, it's not a myth, actually. It's but there's this this widely held understanding that Japanese high school students are incredibly diligent, hardworking, uber intellectual, and just nose to the grindstone 100% of the time. And in my case, there were a few of those students at my high school, but most of them were surf punks. And who, you know, were going to grow up and they were going to inherit the family business that, you know, might be, you know, you in more cases, in most cases, the family business was a fishing boat. And so, you know, these were incredibly rough and tumble kids who liked to get in beach fights with visiting tourists and things like that, and surf, like big time surfing. And you know, their hair was all bleached orange from the seawater, you know, and so it was kind of a wild place, not the sophisticated, you know, urban Tokyo.
Yeah, not at all the Japan I was picturing when you said you.
No, it was pretty wild. So at about I don't know, maybe sometime around New Year's, which is a big deal over there. I was coming out of my house, and my house was it was a guest house at a minshuku, which is like a bed and breakfast type of place, and it was all, you know, kind of crammed together in these tight little alleys in this tiny little village. And I'd been there for 3 months and hadn't noticed this other door in that alley. And so finally I popped out at the right time, and that other door flings open, and a bunch of my high school students come tumbling out. And they're clearly wasted. And what I had discovered was this was the student bar on the island. And so they don't take their drinking age very seriously over there, apparently. And I was ushered in, and it turns out that this place was not only the sort of student hangout for the upperclassmen at the high school, but it was also like the sort of local karaoke joint. And, you know, it was tiny, you know, just a couple of tables and a bar. You know, it was a bottle service type place where you'd buy a really expensive bottle of brandy and keep it behind the bar, and they'd charge you for setups and that kind of thing. And, so the deal was, that, you know, you'd show up and everybody had already had a lot to drink. And you'd get ushered in there, and you know, like, and I went to a, you know, university, Cal State Chico. It was a big party school.
Yeah, you felt like you could hold your own,
right? And yeah. So I tried to keep up, which was impossible. And so they were drinking shochu and brandy or beer. That was pretty much it. And and doing a lot of karaoke, right? And I wasn't into karaoke. I'm kind of famously shy. And but it was insisted upon just over and over again. It was like a social obligation, you know? And so they had these enormous laser discs, and they'd bring them out, and they'd be like, okay, Donlin, your song. And I'd be like, I don't read Japanese, I don't know. And so somebody pulled out one of these laser discs at one point, and it had this song on it, and the lyrics were in fact in English. Like, oddly enough, like this one song on this collection of discs, the one song had English lyrics. And so that became my song. Over and over again, and
and sang it,
and I sang it to the best of my ability. You know,
you talk it or did you sing it?
Well, I did my best, and but the thing is I'd never heard it in real life beforehand.
Oh, so you weren't modeling?
No. So,
a recording of that would be great to have for today,
right? Yeah, I'm sure, but it was. just this bizarre song. And it's got some strange little sections where the melody just completely escapes me. And so I would just fake it, you know.
And they loved it.
And yeah, I mean, like, and so that was that. And so every time I'd go back into the bar, I'd be like, oh, your song. And then I'd, you know, get a couple of drinks in me and then the tiny bubbles would happen.
Tiny Bubbles by Don Ho.
That's right.
From his 1966 album of the same name. Let's hear.
Tiny Bubbles. Head of wine, make me happy, make me feel fine.
Tiny bubbles make me warm.
You know, because of the way music and memory works, there's very likely at least one Japanese person in their mid-40s who remembers you singing that song.
That might be the case.
Were you swaying a little bit to it? Were you?
Oh, yeah.
Because you got to.
Yeah. And, you know, it's that might be only the second time I've actually heard it. And so I'm like, yeah, I didn't get it right.
You sent me two links to the other songs and then said, just go find this one.
Right. So I had no idea, you know. I'm sure you could find the 1992 karaoke version if you looked hard enough. But no, I got that really wrong.
Okay, let's talk about songs that almost made it on your list. Did you start from a list and whittle it down? Because you've been on the inside of the conversations about this since before we launched, so it's been sort of rattling around in your head on some level. So what was song number four or five, or what didn't? What almost made it?
God, there was Philip Glass's. It was basically the whole soundtrack to Koyaanisqatsi. And I don't know if you're a Philip Glass fan.
I know who he is.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where the music tied to the movie is one of the strongest sort of film and music combinations I've ever seen. And it really literally changed the way I looked at the world.
How so? Can you like crystallize that?
It's sort of odd, but if you've ever seen the movie and the way it sort of juxtaposes nature and technology and man's impact on both.
What's it called again?
Koyaanisqatsi. It's the title. I couldn't spell it for you if you paid me, but the title is supposedly Hopi, a Hopi phrase meaning life out of balance. It's one of those things that I just highly, highly recommend you go check out sometime and watch. There's no dialogue. It's all just music and film. Growing up, there's a lot of desert imagery for some reason, and I don't know if that has to do with the Native American themes going on in there. But growing up in the desert or near the desert, it sort of resonated with me and made me kind of look at the world around me in terms of systems. That sounds really vague, but I think it kind of encouraged me to zoom in and out of perspectives more easily. I know that's weird, but I went to art school, so I'm allowed.
Well, it's not that there's a film that sounds like what you're describing, but the title doesn't resonate with me, where it's just – it goes from different culture to different culture, and it's just still shots, and there's music playing behind it. But it's not that one.
This Koyaanisqatsi film was part of a trilogy – by, I think the artist's name is Reggio. And he did Powakatsi and I forget the name of the third one. But then there's been a more recent filmmaker, I think, that's been doing work in a similar vein, whose name I can't remember.
I'm Googling. Baraka is the one I'm thinking
yeah,
of.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
called Baraka.
Yeah.
It came out in 1992, yeah. so right when you would have been in Japan.
Yeah.
But that's interesting because that movie changed the way I looked at the world because it shows this universality.
Yeah.
You know, it goes from the big city to the small town to the big people to the little people to the old people to the young people to the
right.
you know, and it just
yeah.
by the end of it, you're just overwhelmed with, wow, we're all just people on
right.
this planet
yeah.
doing this thing,
yeah.
you know? Wow.
And so I can't explain it, but it's sort of like you remember The Fifth Element.
Oh yeah,
you know where Lilo Dallas is, you know, learning about humanity through this just massive influx of film images.
And
it's sort of like that, where like after an hour and a half of this, you feel like you have a new level of understanding about humanity. You know, and we can all you know feel very smart and pat ourselves on the back for this new perspective.
And we could use another reboot of that these days,
right?
Maybe.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Where are you at musically today? You said you're exploring stuff with your kid via Spotify. I mean, is there any like new bands that you've found that you're into? Is there any modern music that's coming out of the radio that you're into?
Another good question. Right now, I got a car and the car came with Sirius.
Huh?
And
like you don't even have to pay?
Yeah, for the first 2 years,
wow.
I think. And it's pretty interesting. There's some really good stuff out there. There's some absolute garbage. But there's this one program I'm listening to and it's Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Hmm.
And it's just sort of like a deeper look at garage bands or things that are lumped in
cool.
there and, you know, B-sides and stuff like that. But it's, you know, I'll be driving around with my son, Daniel, and we'll be listening to music and there'll be this amazing, you know, thing that sounds like a rock standard. And neither of us had ever heard of the song or the band or, you know, and so being stuck listening to other than WGCU,
I was going to get that in there somewhere.
FM is kind of a wasteland, you know, when it comes to actually listening to quality music. And so we've been listening to kind of, you know, not great stuff on the radio for a long time. And then this just trove of old, unheard of stuff. Has just been a real goldmine. And so what we've been doing is we'll listen to something we like and then we'll go track down more of it and Spotify it.
You know, I kind of have a similar story with my daughter who's 13 on the other end of the technology spectrum. Our favorite channel that we listen to, if I'm listening to anything with WGCU on FM, it's 93.3 The Tiger. It's a low power station out of Dunbar High School.
Oh.
And they've got all kinds of weird stuff. But on Sundays, they've got Rocket Man Roberts Classic Radio Hour. And
oh, I'm checking this out.
It's 3 hours long. It's got bumpers. I mean, they are totally channeling like an old yesteryear of radio.
That is fantastic.
And he plays some stuff that you're like, oh, okay, I've heard that song. But then all of a sudden, he'll play a song and you're like 30 seconds in and you're like, I don't know this, but it's like, you know, it's a B-side or it's the seventh track off of an album by a band that you do know. And I just love it because it's like, why aren't all the radio stations doing this? Play things I don't know, please.
Right. I mean, that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah. No, Rocket Man Roberts. Check it out.
I'm going to check it out.
I want to try to Google this guy and find him.
Well, we got
to
get him in here.
Absolutely. Oh, now on this show.
Right.
Wow. You'd think I would think things like that. okay. Let's move on to your third song.
Okay. This one's a little tricky. Growing up, my dad was a huge movie buff, and almost savant-like. His dad was an LAPD beat cop, and you know, and kind of a famous one at that. and old Sergeant Harry Donlan, and his beat was Pershing Square. And down there, that's also where they had all the theaters in downtown L.A., where my mom and dad both grew up. And as a result of this, you know, of how the LAPD worked in those days, my grandfather would get a bunch of side security jobs at these movie theaters. And as a result of that, my dad just grew up in movie theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has this savant-like memory of just all of these incredible movies from the 40s and 50s and 60s. And so and we used to, you know, tease him about it. You'd name a movie and just randomly, and he'd tell you the studio that produced it, the director, the main stars.
He was like the guys with baseball stats,
exactly.
But it was the movie stats.
Yeah, how many minutes, you know, it was and everything. And he kind of memorized the Film Goer's Companion, which was the Bible of – it was sort of like the IMDb of
yeah.
Of
well, I remember the Siskel and Ebert fat book they would put out every year. That was pretty much how you – that was the IMDb.
Yeah. And so he instilled in all of us and you know, my mom was into it too. But we liked watching old movies. And somewhere along the way, we got he turned us onto these old Busby Berkeley movies. And I don't know if you're a Busby Berkeley fan.
No, I don't know. I don't know that.
So they were, and I think they were old 20th Century Fox musicals, and he would do, for some reason I thought they were MGM, but I'm probably getting that wrong. But he was the one, if you think back at those old movies from the 30s and 40s, of all the crazy dance routines where the chorus girls would be lined up by the – literally like the hundreds, all like rotating neon hoops in perfect unison and making bizarre kaleidoscopic images with their arms and legs. And, you know, there would be swimming involved and all that sort of stuff. So we all, you know, grew up really enjoying these Busby Berkeley movies. And you know, and this was as a little kid, this was all pre-cable TV, you know, on demand, even pre-videotape. And so when one of them would come on TV, it was kind of like an event. We'd all sit around and, you know, enjoy them. And then, you know, the world of videotape came and you'd get a copy of one of these things. And as a kid, he brought home, like one of his students gave him an old video copy of this this old movie, another Busby Berkeley musical called The Gang's All Here, right? And it was this amazing World War II era goofy movie, you know, just ridiculously silly with all of these crazy characters in it. I mean, it had and you know, let me know if you know any of these names resonate with you. But Carmen Miranda was in it and has one of the amazing songs of her career in here. That I think it's the girl with the Tutti Frutti hat.
Mm-hmm.
And Alice Faye is in there, and Eddie Cantor and Benny Goodman is did all the music for the movie. And oh my God, they just Ruby Keeler, the dancer, I think, is in there, and it just sort of goes on and on. I mean, literally, the gang is all there, and the you know, the plot, there is no plot. It's just all of this goofiness of these people, you know, a lot of farcical nonsense, and but wonderful songs and wonderful dances and all of that strange Busby Berkeley imagery. I mean, the guy was just a nut. I mean, the closing scene of the movie are one of the themes of the movie is polka dots for some reason, and so the closing scene is a different rendition of the song you're about to play being played and sung by every major character in the movie as their head floats off in a sort of disembodied polka dot bubble. That then turns into, I think, Alice Faye's dress. I mean, it's bizarre, hallucination inspiring kind of weirdness. And as a kid and a teenager and into my 20s, I just really loved all of this goofy stuff. And you know, the the artistry that went into it, and the, you know, these magnificent soundstage productions were just fantastic. And so, as a result, this particular song really stuck in my head for years and years and years. And it's sort of the main love theme from the movie. And then when Francesca and I got married, we needed to come up with a you know, our wedding song. And I thought, well, this has got to be it. And she had something else in mind. Again, I guess with our theme of miscommunication, she had her song in mind for our wedding song, and I had my song in mind. And I'm sure that's not a completely unique story, but we had this was in Rhode Island, and we had this neat little country club orchestra playing at our band. It was Phil Tandy's orchestra. It was like a 5-piece little band.
And, tie that yellow ribbon.
Yeah, yeah. And it was like that. And they were very old school, very classy guys. And we actually managed to I just kind of mentioned this in passing because I was also going to grad school and I was also working full time. So I was just like really busy. And so I mentioned this in passing to my mother-in-law, who was kind of helping things get coordinated. And she mentioned it to Phil Tandy, you know, and he went off and found the sheet music for this, you know, 60-year-old song. And so sure enough, it was there at our wedding, and our wedding was nuts. It was absolutely bonkers, and in the best way. My wife's family lives out on this piece of land in Rhode Island that's surrounded by ocean on three sides, and and so the reception was going to be under a big tent on the very point of this land, and it had all been set up and arranged and everything. And while we were and of course, you know, nobody was paying attention to the weather. And while we were actually in the ceremony, this gale blew up that if we'd been paying attention, we would have known had been moving in our direction for quite a while and threatened to just tear this huge tent down and everything. And so they actually managed to move the entire reception out of the tent and into her family's sort of ancestral home, which was this, you know, 200-year-old house that they called the Ruins because it had actually burned down once and only been partially rebuilt. But it was...
And nobody was living there.
Oh, no.
Or was...
Yeah, no. Aunt Gladys was living there at the time. And that was Francesca's great aunt, Gladys. And... She was gracious to kind of move everything out, and there was this thing that they called the big room, which was apparently big enough to get all of us in. I mean, and so, you know, another one of the cousins kind of snuck off and recruited a bunch of people, and they in the, you know, 2 hours that the ceremony took place, they got everything moved a quarter of a mile down the road and stuffed into this old funny house. And people were just jam-packed in there, elbow to elbow. And it was the most fun. And this huge storm blowing up outside and, you know, just rain and wind and just craziness. And there was... it was a full open bar, and so everyone was just having a wonderful time and dancing, and finally, you know, and nobody could hear anything, and then so finally the song came on, and Francesca and I had, you know, kind of an awkward shuffling dance in this just throng of people, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful time, you know, family from all over the place came. So yeah, but the miscommunication is every, you know, like for years and years afterwards, you know, occasionally when it would come up, and this is where I'm gonna really hang it out over the edge here, is I can't remember
what Francesca's version of our wedding song was right?
You hear that?
Right. And so for years she was in denial this song had even been played at our wedding. And so finally, just not too many months ago for our 20th anniversary, she gave me a little book going back all of those 20 years and photos from each of the years with, a meaningful little blurb for each one of the photos. And the title of the book was A Journey to a Star.
Hmm.
And so she finally acknowledged it, So
slow and steady wins the race.
Right?
Okay, well, let's listen to it. This is Journey to a Star, performed by Alice Faye. And I Googled this. It was first recorded by Judy Garland.
Yeah.
All right. Well, here we go.
A journey to a star would not be very far as long as I'm alone with you. Romantic as we are, a journey to a star could start before the dawn breaks through. You're right beside my heart, we're just about a kiss apart, and we could make a dream come true. A moment of your love would have the feeling of a journey to a star with you.
So your wedding band was able to move their whole rig too?
Oh, it was great. A little five-piece orchestra. It was fantastic. A guy with a little jazzy drum kit and they all had their matching suits.
So there was no piano? No piano involved?
There might have been,
So they just rolled it down the hill, I guess.
Well, there might have been a piano in the house.
Oh, okay.
But, but it was one of those things where when everyone was in there, I mean, people were literally jammed shoulder to shoulder in there. You really couldn't see much of what was going on. Things got crazy. I mean, there are plenty of stories about
Yeah, it sounds like you mixed all that together in an open bar. Yeah. It sounds like,
No, it was a good time.
There's pictures?
There are pictures, yeah.
Is there any video?
That's a good question. Not that I've seen.
Not that it's part of the family tradition yet.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so is there a TV theme song you can sing on demand?
Oh, yeah. Gilligan's Island, right? I mean, I think that's the requisite. Rawhide, maybe.
Okay.
All of that stuff. Not that I'm going to do that for you, but...
Stick Martin, who co-created our theme song, said Gilligan's Island, but then he pointed out that he didn't know the closing lyrics because he said they were a little different every week or something like that. I feel like I need to go back and check that.
I think they did it differently for a couple of different seasons.
Oh, maybe the seasons changed or something
like that. But yeah.
So Gilligan's Island was a big part of your formative years?
I have a theory that the characters on Gilligan's Island sort of form a perfect pantheon of human personalities.
Wow.
And that you can
this some thought, Mr. Donnelly.
Yeah, and you can sort of describe yourself as being a Gilligan or a Ginger or a Mr. Howell or a combination.
Archetypes.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right, yeah.
Hmm. You know, Megan Kissinger, who we recently had on the show, and she kind of left us with this thought, and I think it keeps coming back to me. I keep thinking about it, and it came up earlier as we were talking. The collective experience that we used to share through media, whether it would be Gilligan's Island when everybody sat down and watched the new Gilligan's Island when it came out, or what she referred to as like back, even further, everybody was listening to Sinatra because it was just part of the fabric. And she thinks that part of what's caused us to kind of go astray as a culture is that we're all in our little silos.
Yeah,
now,
absolutely.
There's no like collective experience, which is great.
Yeah.
But maybe there's something lost in
that. Well, that's kind of my theory about like,
you know, and is Nirvana. It's like there will never be another Nirvana because there will never be another time when a genuinely alternative band will be in the forefront of popular music, because there is there's no need for that anymore. An alternative band can be perfectly successful or popular with their own little niche of fans.
Yeah, you don't have to be global. You can just have 100,000 people on the planet that love you,
right,
and suddenly you're successful.
And that's that. And so I think nobody I'll be surprised if any other really new form of popular music changes the landscape like they did back then, you know? Yeah.
Time will tell.
Right.
You got a couple kids. Were there any lullabies that came with that?
That,
you know, either retelling of a song or a totally original?
Yeah. Both of my kids, there were songs. I mean, with Katie, my daughter, she, I wish we could get back to that point. But we loved singing Christmas carols together. You know, that was like classic, car time fun, you know. And when Daniel was a baby, he would never, ever sleep. And so to try to lull him into sleeping, I would sing the Marty Robbins classic El Paso.
Have to sing a little
bit
for me.
Down in the West Texas town of El Paso.
Okay, yeah.
so on and so forth, which goes on and on and on and on and on and on. And so I forced myself to learn all of the lyrics because there needed to be a song that long to get that kid to sleep.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. Is there a song that you will always turn off if you have the radio on and it comes on for whatever reason?
Built That City, isn't that?
Yeah, that was like when they went off in their own little thing. I always felt like that song came about through like focus groups.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, there was something unfortunate happened because I think we can all agree, that Airplane was an amazing band, and then something just went wildly off the tracks with that one particular song. So,
album, if you can only listen to one ever again,
it might be. It's probably going to be one of two. It would either be Yes, Fragile, and I think there's something so sort of Baroque about a lot of the way they do things that it doesn't get as tiring as some more programmatic music might. And so that might be one. And then the other one is this collection of classic Schubert art songs that I love and can't think of the name of it, but it's like 20 liter,
Thanks to Mr. Webb.
Exactly. Exactly.
I had a Mr. Webb in middle school. He was the first teacher who like caught my attention, and it was great because I had him for 3 years in middle school because he was a gifted teacher. So I had him in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and then he moved on to the high school and he taught at high school for one of the years. So I had this guy for like four times. Mr. Wyatt, he was my Mr. Webb. Wyatt, and I can't find him. He disappeared.
We're so fortunate to have people like that we cross paths with. And, you know, like I say, growing up with my parents as educators, my dad actually kind of ran the school of education in the town I grew up in. And so, maybe one out of every five teachers I had would have gone through his program. And so in that sense, it was a very small community. And so there was a lot of teacher talk at home and, who knows what and everything. And so we really valued our teachers, they were very important people in our lives.
And now you are one.
Yeah, well, sort of, mostly.
Okay, any final thoughts, and can you give them to me in a robot German accent?
No, I can't. There's not enough alcohol in this building.
Okay.
But this has been fun, and I just look forward to hearing more and more of these.
Well, thank you very much. We make this show in the WGCU studios on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Richard Chinqui is the show's co-creator and producer. Our online content producer is Tara Callaghan. Chris Duffus is our executive producer. Our theme music was created by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio in St. Petersburg, Florida. For this week's parting tune, I'm going back to the early 80s at a YMCA summer camp, which I attended several weeks of with my brother and sister. I would have been in about fifth grade at the time. It was an all-ages camp, meaning there were little kids and big teenagers, made for one hell of a dodgeball game, let me tell you. The song that connects me back to that time is Magic by The Cars. I have this really vivid memory of being in a game room of some kind. We were all crammed inside because it was storming outside, and the teenagers were building these cool balsa wood airplanes that really flew and could do a loop if you knew what you were doing. I remember playing ping pong with some kids my age, watching the older kids throw these little planes around that far exceeded any toy plane I'd ever seen at that point in my life in terms of, I guess, flyability, while this song played in the background. Summertime, summer camp, the 80s, Southwest Florida, good times. I'm Mike Canary. Keep listening.
Next time on Three Song Stories.
As a youth in northern Minnesota, I very badly played the accordion. My siblings.
Sorry to laugh. There's
you laughed because my siblings voted to sell the accordion at some point in time.